Greetings to our dearly beloved brother and teacher in the faith. The saints in my household salute you. Grace and peace to you in the Lord Jesus Christ. We remember you to God in our prayers daily. Though your return is imminent, we ask that God may not delay your visit to us. There is division here. Men constantly quarrel over who baptized them. Some are claiming they are Paul, others of Cephas, and Apollos even has a following. As for us, we are simply trying to follow Christ. There are other problems that need your urgent attention. We suspect there is a fornicator among us. This man is living with his father's wife. One brother is going to law against another. There are many questions we need you to answer, Brother Paul. Is it unholy for a believer to stay married to his unbelieving mate? And what about the meat offered in Aphrodite's temple? Our business associates are constantly inviting us to the banquets held in her honor each month. Several brethren continue to attend these feasts and claim that no harm is done. After all, we do know the difference between an idol and the true God, Jehovah. Surely the idol is nothing, and the meat offered to it is clean. Would it be a transgression of God's law to attend the feast? God has forgiven us and blessed us, and we continue to honor Him. He is first and foremost in our lives. These matters are pressing, but there are others about which we will write you. Please come swiftly. Greet Timothy, Apollos, Aquila, and Priscilla, brethren who are dear to us. I, Chloe, salute you with my household. Now, you won't find that epistle in the New Testament. It is purely imaginary, but it is interesting to speculate about what that correspondence might have been between the Corinthian brethren and Paul. Those questions that they posed to him, to which he responds in the first epistle of Corinthians. And as so often is the case, when we begin to appreciate a situation in which a particular epistle is written, we begin to appreciate, I think, more closely its application, even in our lives today. And such is the case with this epistle written to the Corinthians. I want to focus particularly this evening on the section starting with chapter 8 and continuing through chapter 10. I know that we've studied this recently, and perhaps I'll just be repeating some things that have been said already. But maybe, in addition to that, we'll notice some things that we didn't perhaps have time to notice in our Bible studies concerning this section. It's evident that the brethren in Corinth have a question about whether or not to attend those feasts at which meat was being sacrificed to idols. And we pick up on that in chapter 8 at verse 1 when Paul says, "Now concerning things offered to idols." He says, "We know that we all have knowledge." Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. It seems that Paul anticipates here the attitude among these brethren, that they knew the difference between the idol that they had once worshipped and the true and living God. And yet he cautions them at the very outset. He said, "Be aware that knowledge will puff up. It will make one proud." And that's not hard to understand. I think that's even the case today. When someone has a certain degree of knowledge, maybe an actual degree attached to their name, it can easily leave the appearance, because of that knowledge, of knowing more than someone else and therefore being better than someone else who doesn't have such knowledge. And that's the way it often works. Indeed, in the world, that's the way it works. And Paul cautions against that. He says, as far as a Christian is concerned, it's not just a matter of knowing, but it's a matter of exercising love. But particularly, he says, in reference to these brethren, that there are those who had been accustomed in the past to eating these things sacrificed to idols. And he, in fact, admits that we all have a particular knowledge. Verse 5, he says, "For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for Him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live." And yet notice that in verse 7 he says, "However, there is not in everyone that knowledge." Now maybe we need to just stop and think about what it is that he's actually saying. Is he saying that there are Christians who had turned away from that idols who still do not yet know that there is only one God? That somehow they've become Christians under the delusion that these idols still exist and that they are something? Well, that's not the case. He explains what he means when he says in verse 7, "For some with consciousness of the idol until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled." That is, it's difficult for them to break away from the chains that bind them to the past. They are so accustomed to recognizing that idol and its significance that even knowing that there is only one God, they do it and their conscience is defiled. And so Paul's advice is this. In verse 10 he says, "For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died?" He says in verse 13, "Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble." And so because of that conscience of the brother, Paul says, forego that liberty that you may well have. You could eat that meat, discerning that there is no such thing as the idol, but beware lest you cause someone else to stumble. At that point, Paul seems to take a turn in his thinking. In chapter 9, he begins to talk about his rights as an apostle. He talks about his credentials in the first couple of verses there. And then he mentions in verse 5, "Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do also the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working?" Now, Paul talks in this entire chapter about the matter of having the right as an evangelist to be supported of the gospel. And he goes on to give a number of different reasons why that is the case. But his interest is not particularly just receiving support from these brethren. His interest is in demonstrating to them that he as an evangelist has some liberties that he has foregone for the basis of helping these brethren. He says later in the chapter, "so that he may present the gospel without charge." He has been commissioned to go and preach, and he desires to do that. He has become all things to all men. Indeed, to the extent that down in verse 27 he says, "I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." Now, what's he trying to say to these brethren? I think, again, he anticipates their response to what he has said thus far. They would say, "Yes, Paul, we know. We know about what you're saying. We know that there are certain rights that we should forego, but you just don't understand. We understand the difference between the true God and an idol. And certainly to go along to such a feast and to eat such meat is not compromising our faith. Why, we're Christians. We have been blessed by God. We have received the things of God. And surely there is no harm that can be done by going to such a feast as this and partaking of this meat." Well, Paul continues, I think, the thought in verse 1 of chapter 10. When he appeals back to the Old Testament and reminds them of the Israelites, he says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud. All passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." What blessing was there that God had denied the Israelites as he took them and formed from them his peculiar people, his special nation, and then proceeded to provide for them as he gave them that law at Sinai and give them every kind of thing that they would need? And as Paul suggests here, they were even benefiting not only from the things he gave them, but spiritually the things he was giving them were pointing forward to the very Christ that would one day come. And yet the reminder in verse 5 is, "But with most of them God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness." Despite being God's people, having his blessings and provisions, these people stumbled. They fell. They were not so strong that they couldn't be overtaken by Satan himself. And in fact, he goes on to mention the different ways by which they had fallen. Notice in verse 6, he says, "Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." back in Numbers 11, you remember that as the children of Israel get ready to make their journey, one of the first things apparently that they begin to do is to complain because of the way things are. In verse 4 it says, "Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes.'" Can you identify with that kind of thinking? How often is it that we have some privilege or some blessing and we're separated from that from a very short time and we just begin thinking back to what it was like when we had those things? And we began remembering what that was like. Sometimes for someone who becomes a Christian, that is particularly difficult. To have been involved in some particular activity, to become a Christian, and then look back with longing eyes at what it was that they once enjoyed. Paul says they lusted after evil things. And then he mentions in verse 7 the example of idolatry. He says, "And do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." Back in Exodus 32, God leading them to Mount Sinai, has Moses come up and he speaks there to Moses. He gives him the law, only to find that as Moses descends the mountain, the people have given up on Moses. Why, that's just that man that led them out to the mountain. And they ask Aaron, they request of him to make them gods that they may worship. And that's what they began to do. And so he cautions them against idolatry. And for the Corinthians, that was a particular problem. They were surrounded by idols. And even today, I think there is the temptation for us to fall prey to idolatry, not necessarily the image as such, but to those things that become more important to us than our pursuit of godly living and following Christ. And then in verse 8, he speaks of fornication. He says, "Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell." This is an allusion back to Numbers chapter 25, when after that 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, the children of Israel now enter into the land of Moab across from the land of Canaan. And there they are encamped, awaiting that passage into the land. And as they do so, the record there tells us that they began to be seduced by the idolatry of the Moabites into Baal worship. And they began to partake of that, and the men began to take the women of Moab. In fact, one of them brings a Moabitess woman into the camp, and God sends a plague upon the camp of the Israelites that stopped only when Phinehas, one of the priests, takes a spear and goes into the tent of that man and thrusts it through both the man and the woman. They were guilty of fornication. And Paul uses this as a reminder to the Corinthians, who might easily have been seduced into the living and the immorality that surrounded them. Certainly in the temples, it was no uncommon thing for such to be taking place. And he warns them of the danger that they would fall prey to in participating in those kinds of things. And then he speaks in verse 9 of temptation. He says, "Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by Satan." And we often think of temptation as something we have to endure. It's used here in the sense, as we used it this morning, of testing. But here it's describing a testing that is done in reference to God. The children of Israel were testing God in the sense that they were trying His patience when they were disobedient. Yet another instance of their discontent there in the wilderness is manifested here in Numbers 21, when it says that they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. Again, that's not hard for us to identify with, is it? To become discouraged because the way grows long and hard and difficult, and we wonder if we're really going to make it to the end of the path. And so sometimes it's very easy, as they did, for us to lose our faith and just to think, are we ever going to be able to complete the journey? Verse 5 says, "The people spoke against God and against Moses, 'Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread.'" They were testing God. Here is God who had taken care of them every step of the way over that 40 years, even though he had caused that first generation to perish. They were still alive. They had survived. God had provided for them. And now they wondered whether they were going to make it. And God sent serpents among them and begins to have the people killed by the serpents until a serpent is lifted up among them at which they could gaze and which by which that plague could be removed. And then finally, he speaks of a murmuring that took place. I suppose many of these would classify as such, but he's thinking here of a particular instance in which the people murmured against God. In verse 10 he says, "Nor complain, as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer." Now this apparently is an allusion back to Numbers chapter 16. And on this occasion, while they were wandering in the wilderness, Korah and some of his brethren confront Moses, and they began to complain. I think there were about 250 of them of the priestly tribe. And basically they say to Moses, "You're taking all the lead in this. Why is it that we cannot have some of the authority apportioned to us?" And God responds by telling Moses, "You have Korah and his brethren come before me with their censers and the incense on their censer." And so the following day when they do that, God causes the ground to open and Korah and his brethren are destroyed. But the complaining of which he speaks here is not that particular instance. The chapter continues to describe that the people the following day come before God and they began to complain to God for having destroyed Korah and his brethren. And God begins to destroy them, and again, that plague is only stopped as a result of intercession by the part of one of the priests there. Now, the entirety of that is to suggest to these brethren in Corinth that you need to be careful. You need to show great concern. You can be overtaken just as they were overtaken. In fact, he goes on to say in verse 11, "These things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." And then he issues this statement in verse 12. He says, "Therefore, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." I believe his answer at last to these brethren who are being solicited to attend these feasts, who perhaps could see no wrong in going along and attending such a feast, Paul's answer to them is, you be careful. Because the moment that you think that you have so much knowledge, that you're so strong, that very moment is the moment that you're most vulnerable to falling prey to Satan and what he has by which to charm you. The problem is not necessarily being strong or standing, it's thinking that we stand. And I suppose we have to guard against the same danger today. There is that capacity, that temptation for us to start thinking that we can rely upon our strength and our standing in the Lord, and somehow we're so strong that something's not going to overtake us. Have you ever known that to happen to some other Christian? Have you seen that in an instance where someone was overtaken, seemingly a very strong and faithful Christian, and yet falling prey to some difficulty, some temptation? I certainly have, and not only have I seen it in others, I have certainly experienced it in my own life, thinking that somehow I'm immune to some particular temptation or problem, and then seeing myself succumb to that very thing. We have an example in the New Testament of that very kind of thing, the example of the Apostle Peter. You remember back in Matthew chapter 26, that as Peter and the apostles are gathered around Jesus just before his death, Jesus warns them about the fact that on that night when he is going to be betrayed, they are going to stumble. He says in verse 31, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you into Galilee." And then Peter answers and says, "Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble." Now, Peter's not just making an idle boast. He shows his courage later on. When Jesus, as he is being taken, Peter raises the sword and attempts to defend his Lord. And it stayed only when Jesus says, no, that's not what my kingdom is about. Don't take up a sword to fight. And yet Peter was made to think at this time and talk about the fact that he would not deny the Lord. In fact, he says, Jesus says in verse 34, assuredly I say to you that this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. Peter said to him, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And so said all the disciples. Aren't you glad our lives have not been put under the microscope of the Scriptures as is Peter's? I sometimes shudder to think what it would be like to have the inconsistencies in our lives reported as they were here. But they serve a useful purpose. And I think that's how the Spirit intends them to be used. Peter thinking here that he and the other apostles are going to do whatever it takes in order to defend their Lord. And yet just a short time later, as Jesus is taken in the garden, we find in chapter 26, Peter denying the Lord three different times, just as the Lord had predicted. And later in John chapter 21, Jesus, after his resurrection, appears yet again to his apostles, this time in Galilee. And he finds them there fishing by the sea, as was their vocation. And as he bids them come to the shore, Peter rushes to the shore, and Jesus confronts Peter there. And notice in John 21, verse 15, Jesus says to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, feed my lambs. He said to him again a second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. And then in verse 17, he says to him the third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Now what do you picture there as John is confronted by Jesus? I picture John almost unable to lift his eyes and to look Jesus in the eye. Knowing what he has done just a short time before. Knowing that he has denied his Lord and now having to face him. And Jesus interrogating him, asking him, Simon, do you love me? Are you really concerned for me? Are you willing to be committed to me? And Simon each time answering, yes, Lord. Now the question is, when was Peter the strongest? When he was boasting of his faith and saying to the Lord, Lord, we'll stand with you. We will die even if it comes to that. Or is it on this occasion when he recognizes in his humility the fact that he's not as strong as he thought he was? I would suggest from a worldly standpoint, it would seem that first time was Peter at his strongest, but this is really when Peter is made to rely not upon his own strength, but upon God himself. And so often it is necessary for us, when we think we stand, to begin to rely upon the Lord. There are things that we can rely upon that seem to offer for us a strength and a stability, and yet we need to be careful that those things aren't what we are counting on. There is the element of self-righteousness against which the Scriptures warn continually. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12. Paul talks about an element that had come among the Corinthians, apparently at a later point, and he describes their frame of mind. He says, for we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves, but they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. One of the pitfalls of developing a self-righteous attitude is to begin to start comparing ourselves with each other. And that's easy to do. And if I start asking myself, well, am I a faithful Christian? It's easy for me to start devising a standard by which I just start comparing myself to someone else. And usually when we do that, we tend to pick the one who is weaker than ourselves. And we say, well, you know, I must be a better Christian than brother or sister so-and-so because, you know, I'm here more often than they are, or I sing louder than they do, or I'm more active than they are. And it's very easy to develop such an attitude. It's the attitude described in Luke 18 when Jesus tells that parable of the Pharisee and the publican. The Pharisee in his self-righteous manner going into the temple and almost boasting to God himself about all that he's accomplished. Whereas the publican, it says, smites his breast and won't even lift his eyes to God and asks God that he be merciful to him as a sinner. There's no room for self-righteousness. When we compare ourselves to God's standard, we see ourselves as we are, in need of his mercy to help us from day to day. And it will develop within us a reliance upon God and what he has for us, rather than a reliance upon our own strength as such. There is also, I think, the element of self-sufficiency. Over in Luke chapter 12, Jesus tells yet another parable, this time warning the audience as a result of a question that is asked him about settling an inheritance, warning the audience against covetousness. And he tells about this rich man who has accumulated great wealth and apparently is just thinking about, preoccupied with his wealth and what he's going to do with it, and decides he's going to build bigger barns in which to store the fruits of his labors. And Jesus refers to the man as a fool for failing to realize that that very night his soul was required of him. It's so easy for us sometimes to rely upon the sufficiency that we have, and we have an abundant sufficiency. We have so many different needs that are taken care of, and men are working all the time to provide other ways by which to make our lives easier and more convenient. And all of that can have the illusion for us that somehow we don't really quite need God as much as we do. That somehow we are sufficient and we can get along without him. And it's only when we realize that that's not the case, when we suffer some loss, when something is taken away from us, that we begin to depend fully upon him as we should. There is the matter of reputations. John describes over in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 2, the church at Sardis, as the Spirit writes to this particular church, notice how it earmarks this group of people. He says in verse 2, be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found your works perfect before God. And the verse preceding it is the one I intended to note. I know your works, that you have a name that you are alive, but you are dead. It's very easy to begin to rely upon a reputation. And there's nothing wrong with having a good reputation. Throughout the Scriptures, Paul and others recommend brethren to other brethren based upon the good reputation that they have. But that reputation, that name, is simply not enough. It has to be backed up on a continual basis by the works that we demonstrate as a result of an active faith on our part. And if we're not careful to make sure that it's not just a reputation, then we can fall prey to thinking that we are as good as the press clippings indicate, that we're something special on our own, which, of course, is not the case. Well, finally, let me suggest that in reference to this very matter of right and wrong, it seems like that was really the biggest problem in Corinth. Their sufficiency in their own minds thinking that knowing the difference between right and wrong constitutes being strong and faithful. Now that's the first step towards it, but that's not the only answer to it. The way to disregard temptation, the way to avoid it, is not merely in knowing the difference between right and wrong, but being able to recognize and stay away from it. And that's so difficult to do in our time. We are surrounded by the world, by its trappings. We are surrounded by a sexually craving society, and it seems to be bent upon pleasure and enjoying those things for ourselves, and it offers that kind of thing to us at every turn. It's so easy to be taken in by those kinds of trappings and to be allured by those kinds of temptations, to fill our minds with those kinds of things, even though we know the difference between what is right and what is wrong. In terms of the entertainment in which we participate, it's not simply enough to know the difference between what God expects and what he doesn't. Just as these brethren find themselves in a compromising position because of their attitude that, well, if we know the difference, we can go ahead and attend these feasts. Paul seems to be telling them at this juncture that that's not enough, that you have to go the extra step and avoid even the very appearance of evil. And how well that will serve us as we try and build our lives around what Christ wants us to be. The matter of staying away from the bottom of the precipice there is not seeing how close we can build the fence to it. It's making sure that we are distant from it and that we're not going to get close enough where we can fall. The danger comes in thinking that we're so strong that nothing can overtake us. Well, how do we fight against that? It's not that Paul is saying here that there is no way that we can be strong. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10, Paul says, "Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might." Where does our strength lie? It lies in a trust and a faith in God, in a recognition that out of any temptation, God will make this way of escape possible. Look at verse 13 in chapter 10. He says, "No temptation has taken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it." God is working on our behalf. He wants us to be faithful, and He will do everything within His ability to provide that way of escape. And when we develop that attitude that we must rely upon Him, that we are not too strong to fall, then we are going to see those ways of escape that He makes possible for us. And most of the time, when we take that path instead of the path that draws us closest to that temptation, we're so much better off for it anyway. We become strengthened in the very activities in which we're involved. We're generally around people who are going to influence us to do better. And as a result of that, our faith is going to be stronger. We sang the song a moment ago, "A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing." Indeed, God is someone upon whom we can depend. And so as we grow in our knowledge is important. It is the basis upon which we make judgments, the basis upon which we know the difference between right and wrong. But it by itself is not sufficient. It must exercise itself in a discerning between right and wrong, in taking the right course that God has supplied for us. And in those ways, we can become strong as God wants us to be and avoid the temptations and the pitfalls that Satan places before us. Let us learn, as the Corinthians no doubt learned, that compromising with evil is not the way by which to be strengthened, but rather a trust in the Lord will serve us well. If you're here this evening and you're not a child of God, we have the opportunity made available to you to respond to the gospel. And again, we would just raise the question, upon what are we going to rely? Are we strong enough in our own spiritual state to stand before God in judgment and to somehow rely upon the things that we have done and that's going to see us into heaven? The Bible makes it very clear that that's not enough. That it's only by the forgiveness that we have through Jesus Himself that we can be in fellowship with God. If you desire that forgiveness, God has made that way possible. An escape out of your past life and into a relationship with Him. If that's what you desire, we ask that you come as together we stand and sing the song of invitation.